Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. A housekeeping note first. The show will be moving from Saturday mornings on KPFA to Thursdays at noon, starting this coming week. Just one guest up today, a long conversation with Adam Davidson, host of NPR's Planet Money and a columnist for the New York Times Magazine, about the economy, bourgeois journalism, and nastiness on the Internet. More on how that came to be in a bit. Just a very few words about Wisconsin. Walker's victory in the recall election is a major defeat for the good guys. I had a lot to say about this on my blog, lbo-news.com, lbo-news.com, and I'll be returning to the topic on the next show. For now, I'll just say a couple of things. One, like it or not, we have to admit that unions are not all that popular with the broad public. And two, the defeat shows the foolishness and futility of channeling a genuine popular upsurge into the morose realm of electoral politics. To be clear, it was the union leaders who decided on this strategy. God knows what they were thinking, but I suspect it had something to do with their fear of popular mobilizations. Anyway, more on this in the next show. And I invite listeners to check out my pieces on this on lbo-news.com. lbo-news.com, by far the most popular post in the history of my little blog. Okay, now on to Adam Davidson. Besides hosting NPR's Planet Money, Davidson is a columnist for the New York Times Magazine. Last January, Davidson wrote a column defending Wall Street. Among other things, he said that it helped make the poor less poor, thanks to credit, enabled the existence of a middle class, also thanks to credit, and made possible all sorts of innovations, from life-saving drugs to artisanal goat cheese. I wrote a blog post denouncing the column as wretched and Davidson as a hack, using exactly those words. I also denounced NPR for being more insidious than Fox, for making palatable, through its image of liberal reasonableness, an orthodox message, even though many in its audience might be open to more critical perspectives. The post was well received by my usual small but choice audience. Within a few weeks ago, I heard through the grapevine that Davidson was looking to talk to one of his left critics. I quickly volunteered, and within an hour, I got an email from him inviting me into the NPR studios in New York for a chat. So we sat down a couple of weeks ago and had it out for well over an hour. He didn't want to broadcast the audio, which was recorded by the NPR engineers, but told me I could do whatever I wanted with it. So here it is, edited down by about a third. If people suspect me of tendentious editing, the full and edited version can be found via a link on my website, leftbusinessobserver.com. I have to say I admire and respect Davidson for the invitation and for the long, serious conversation that follows. I was very nasty about him. I can't say I regret the nastiness. I doubt he would have extended the invitation had I been more measured. I must admit, though, that his generosity and friendliness have made it very unlikely I'll be that nasty again. Okay, here's my chat with Adam Davidson.
So I'm very glad. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, and we're both grown-ups, and I have a thick skin, so like I feel like, you know, it took guts for you, to come in. Here's what I'm trying to understand, which is, in the last 6 months, there's a few different people who are, you know, prominent left-leaning bloggers, including you, who sort of seem to really hate what I do and really hate my work. And I hate to say it, I've wanted to understand it better. So,
well, I can only admire your curiosity, and thank you for inviting me, because I did say some pretty harsh things about you, and now that I am sitting next to you, I regret them to some degree. I don't listen to the show, so I don't really know what you do on there. I don't take it personally. I don't really listen to any talk radio. I just listen to music on the radio because I'd much rather read things, and I just don't have the time to listen to talk on the radio. But, you know, I said some of the recent stuff you'd done for the Times Magazine, really, I thought was you didn't challenge the assertions or assumptions of the prevailing ideology that, you know, the Why We Hate Wall Street column, I thought was very credulous about Wall Street's own version of what it does. For example, Wall Street really does not have much to do with financing real business. Most companies are self-financing, get their investment funds through internal finance, and for the last couple of decades, actually the funding has been going in the other direction, with non-financial companies distributing wads of cash to shareholders through buybacks, dividends, M&A. The venture capital industry is important. It does offer seed money and financing to innovative new companies. But in the scheme of things, it's actually quite small.
And then, of course, the VCs want to get out. The Facebook offering was an egregious example of that. But, you know, the early funders want to get out at some point and move on to something new. So, but VC, you know, I will concede that's important, but it's a very small part of what Wall Street does. Most of what Wall Street does is trading in existing assets. And for that, they make a ton of money. And the social contribution of that is hard to measure. A couple of other things. The Bain guy, whose name now has escaped.
Ed Conard.
And yeah, you did offer some skeptical challenges to him, but I thought they were almost pro forma and buried somewhere in the middle. And you know, the journalistic convention is to say, you know, to be sure, ... But then the conclusion, the opening and conclusion were very friendly to him, I thought. And well, a lot of what he said was, I thought, nonsense. That, for example, people like him, when they invest, they're investing mostly in existing assets. Now, he's a different case because he's a Bain partner. He's investing in Bain, which, you know, is deeply involved in private equity. But your standard issue rich person is just investing in bonds and stocks and funds, maybe hedge funds. But again, very little of that finds its way to actual productive enterprise or anything innovative in any meaningful way. A lot of what he was saying about innovation was very, very selective. I mean, that example of the Coke can was surreal. I don't think that, you know, I don't think inventing something like that puts you in the top 0.1% like Romney. But also, very fundamental innovations in this economy have come from publicly funded enterprises. For example, the computer. Wall Street wanted nothing to do with the computer from like the 1940s into the mid-1960s. Corporate America wanted nothing to do with it. So it was the Pentagon and the Census Bureau really were subsidizing the development of the computer. Same thing with the Internet. You know, that's a Defense Department baby. But even a lot of the things that we think of as features of modern computing, like database technology, the graphic interface, the mouse, all that came out of DARPA, the Defense Research Agency funding. And there have been very, very few fundamental innovations in the computing business since those days. You know, we just keep doing it incrementally better. Intel keeps making faster processors. But that kind of giant leap that the early computer represented and that the graphic interface represented, we don't really have much in the way of that anymore. The pharmaceutical industry, much of that basic research is subsidized by the public sector, National Institutes of Health. Industry doesn't want to do that. They want to develop drugs from that basic research that they can turn into profitable products. They're interested in the D part of R&D, but not the R part. And even he mentions agriculture. There's a tremendous amount of waste in American agriculture. The corn subsidies, for example, are utterly insane and contribute greatly to the obesity problem. But aside from that, you know, a lot of the basic technology in agriculture has also been a result of public funding, federal subsidies, but also, you know, state extension branches and university research, Rutgers, UC Davis, these sorts of things. So, you know, I think this is an extremely selective notion of innovation that focuses just on private actors who really don't have all that much to do with it. And like the private equity business, for example, I'll concede that Bain is probably better than most. I think Bain did more to nurture and develop the companies they invested in than, say, Blackstone. But even so, Bain did its share of asset stripping. Blackstone does plenty of it. These guys really get very, very rich for very dubious social contributions. So I think one of the things that has stoked populist rage inchoately, you know, over the past couple of years, but, you know, ever since the Occupy movement brought it to more public attention, is the disproportion between contribution and reward. People see themselves just sweating away and getting nothing. You know, the average American worker has seen flat to declining real wages for decades now. The only exception, of course, was the late 90s after Bill Clinton increased taxes on the rich. The Bain guy made the point that we need low taxes and that's going to spur innovation. In fact, the Bush years were the worst economic expansion since modern numbers began, but, you know, really, I think probably ever in American history. We had the weakest job growth, the weakest GDP growth, and then followed by the worst recession in modern history. So, just by, it's a small sample size, but on the basis of raising taxes on rich people, we get the 90s boom. Lowering taxes on rich people, we get a terrible mid-2000s boom. So he was allowed to assert a whole lot of things were completely untrue and went largely unchallenged. And then finally, I know I've been talking a long time now, but I was reading the piece about Honduras and the charter cities there. Now, it's a very important point that this guy is the product of a coup.
He was elected. He wasn't.
Yeah, but the previous leader was displaced by a coup. The U.S. kind of accepted that. So it was a very undemocratic thing. But then from My friend Greg Grandin.
Who but I do. I mean, the first sentence.
Yeah. Where I'm taking this is this. My friend Greg Grandin, who teaches Latin American history at NYU, has been looking at this a bit. And he says that Milton Friedman's grandson and Peter Thiel, the PayPal guy and notorious libertarian, are also want to do one of these cities. And they're very explicitly wanting to be not democratic. They think that political democracy is incompatible with their libertarian principles, and they really are very excited about being able to run a city on basically corporate libertarian lines. So, you know, this.
But that's not what I was.
No. Yeah. But I think it's very interesting to look at this whole Honduran experiment. And you know, rumor is one thing, but the Thiel Friedman thing, I think, gives a lie to a lot of claim about libertarianism. And there's an example you bring up. I can't remember this, who brings up the example of Singapore. But you know, Singapore was also a very, very state-centered system. They did a lot to direct the economy, but also it was official policy of the Singaporean government to raise wages. They were not trying to compete for the lowest common denominator. They were really trying to move up the value chain and raise wages and become more technologically complex, and they largely succeeded, which you can say of many of the Asian economies, that very skillful state-directed policy that succeeded in raising wages, raising incomes, reducing poverty, and not by any of the kind of nostrums that we're likely to see in the charter cities in Honduras. A lot of people on the left wouldn't share my opinion on this, but I do admire a lot of what the Chinese have done. I think they've done a very skillful job of developing the economy, directing very impressive rates of economic growth for more than 20 years. They may be running into trouble now, but, you know, what a remarkable run it's been. They've done, you know, it's one of the greatest, I guess, the greatest poverty reduction scheme in human history. But, you know, again, it was very, very state-centered, and certainly a lot of people got rich in China, but it was very skillfully done by a bunch of state planners who, while they're certainly no longer communist in any sense, did believe enough in the power of the state to direct economic growth and did it very skillfully. So I think these are kinds of lessons that we need to think about now that our economy is in pretty serious trouble and showing, you know, it's some signs of recovery, but very weak ones. We need to think about, I think, over the longer term, how to identify potential growth sectors and get the proper state policies necessary to facilitate that, and also how to spread the rewards of economic growth more equally than we've seen. It's a society in which the top 1% or 10%, no matter how we want to slice it, claims such a disproportionate share of income growth is neither just nor stable nor sustainable.
I'm speaking with Adam Davidson, who is a columnist for the New York Times Magazine and host of NPR's Planet Money.
So, and I don't want to like go point by point on each article just because, but a couple things that have confused me in reading your writing and some of the other, not that I can hold you responsible for anyone else's writing, but writing about an idea doesn't mean I like that idea or that I think it's the best idea. And that's something that confuses me. I mean, my thing is we call it a column, but it's not an op-ed column. It's more like a reported essay, I guess, and it's very much not opinionated. I mean, I don't take opinions generally. I don't try to have strong opinions. And then the cover story about Edward Conard, I just was joking because you and others sort of said I was being sort of a propagandist for him. I guess that would be your critique. And I just thought, God, I must be the worst propagandist in the world since that article came out. And, you know, it had, I don't know if it's a record, but the largest number of comments anyone I know at the New York Times Magazine had ever seen. And
what was the drift of the comments?
Like 99.9% negative. And,
really?
And
you or him?
No, against him.
Against him.
Against
yeah.
him. And so I just thought this was not a case of whatever my intentions were of, you know, an article that blinded the world into believing that the ultra-rich need to be more ultra-rich and that only you and a select group of knowledgeable insiders were able to see through. Like,
well, I mean, that guy, you know, he certainly weaves his own rope to hang himself. I mean, he says so many things that would clearly make a lot of people very angry that, you know, just letting him speak, I think, set people off. But
so as a writer, you know, this is not a news story. This is not a reverse pyramid where, you know, the most important things in the first paragraph and the second most important things in the second paragraph. I mean, what I consider what I do, you know, what I try and do anyway, is make economics and finance sort of like you, I think, accessible to a broad audience who feels like they should care about it, who feels like they should know more about it, but doesn't, but finds most business and economics writing a little, you know, they don't understand the jargon, they're confused by it.
Oh, it's like the most mystified area of human activity.
Yeah, and one of the most influential and important.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so when I write an article like this, you know, I would love to do, you know, there is a geeky econ insider part of me that would love to do nothing but lengthy explanations of the true nature of investment, blah, blah, blah. But I just, you know, you go too far and it kills the reader. So, you know, what I felt like as a piece of writing, as a piece of magazine writing, not newspaper writing, you know, I felt like we were very careful in, to the extent we can, like show who this guy is, show how he sees the world, and then provide some context for understanding him. And you say I gave some very milquetoasty sort of very light pro forma criticism, but I don't agree. I mean, I think that I showed that every leading economist I spoke to, including some who were politically aligned with him, dismissed many of his ideas.
Yeah, Schleifer gave him a bit of a seal of approval, right?
Yeah, but yeah. Andre Schleifer is an important financial economist who thinks he's great. You know,
I had the book, and I was thinking of having the guy on the radio, so I'd be curious. I'd like to see what he has to say for himself. But I would say two things. One, on that piece, I guess a lot of those commenters were reacting on an emotional level, and I am, you know, such a geek that I really want to get my facts straight. So I felt I had this fact-checking impulse that when he would say things that I knew to be untrue or extremely biased, I want to say, but. And, you know, somebody like Noam Chomsky thinks that if you just get the facts straight, everything else will take care of itself. I don't believe that. I think people want to believe a lot of things, and any amount of factual refutation may not change minds very effectively. But I still have that impulse to want to get the facts straight, and I thought he got a lot of stuff crooked that should have been straightened out in follow-up questions or, you know, it's not a strict interview format, but in some way there should have been some kind of fact-checking to a lot of stuff he said, like about innovation, about the sources of investment and all that sort of thing. On the Wall Street piece, though, that there was just a lot of stuff that I thought was factually wrong that you said, like the role of innovation or like the artisanal goat cheese makers.
Well, you know what? I will say my big regret with that piece is that I didn't just lay out. Well, there is, I hinted at this, I referenced it, so I didn't not mention it at all. But I felt like what I wished I had done was just very clearly said, Wall Street means lots of different things to lots of different people. There's no official definition. So if Wall Street is, from what I understand, there was a time when Wall Street really just meant the stock exchange on Wall Street. And that's not what I was talking about. I was using Wall Street in the colloquial sense to mean the U.S. banking system.
The whole financial sector.
The broad financial sector. And I think I could have been much clearer in making that point.
But then you make two points in it about for the poor and the middle class who are able to borrow. And I think it's been almost a matter of social policy. And there's an interesting IMF working paper came out a couple of years ago in which they said that it's been quite a conscious social policy to offer easy credit as a substitute for income growth. This is true.
Well, Raghu Rajan wrote this whole book. He was the former IMF chief economist.
Right, yes. And then two staff economists wrote something that drew on that. Yeah, and they tried to model that mathematically. But I think that the part of the reason we're in economic trouble now is precisely that we've just come to the end of the line of this model of using easy credit as a substitute for income growth. We've had, you know, 30 years of attacks on living standards and social spending and wages, union busting and wage cutting and, you know, a stagnant minimum wage, any number of ways of reducing the labor share of national income, which is now quite low, and raising the capital share of national income, which is very quite high, and that has very significant economic and social problems. I mean, the polarization, you know, produces envy and distress, but it also you have to do something to maintain aggregate demand if the mass purchasing power is being squeezed, and borrowing has been used to do that. So now that seems to have run its course. We can't go back to that model. So what's going to happen next? We need to think about precisely what to do next. And just saying that borrowing offered the middle class and a poorer way up. And now we're looking at this with the student debt issue. It's getting very...
But here's where I'm going to really push back on you. I thought about this story because of the time I've spent in Haiti and Iraq and in countries that don't have anything like a modern financial system. And when there is simply... Obviously, there are problems, to put it mildly, there are major problems with our credit system. But when you are in an economy where credit simply doesn't exist... Or exists to such a minimal extent that it effectively doesn't exist, then I think what you see, and you know, this is pretty clear in history and today. The only people who can get money are people who are related to other people who have money, or people who have, you know, access to some kind of political monopoly rent so that they can get corruption. And so...
No, both of those countries are extraordinarily state-centered system that depended on... And in Haiti, it's just... Well, you have to be well-positioned to loot the state. I mean, that's how anybody gets rich in state in Haiti, is by looting the state. And there's no almost no productive enterprise that goes on there at all. So the whole thing is a wreck and has been since they got punished for their colonial anti-colonial rebellion. Iraq, you know, there was some degree of social spending under Saddam that did make things go. And you know, but it was still also an extremely oppressive, state-centered. I don't want to use the word fascist, but it is, you know, this really authoritarian developmental state that was just not a good place to be. But you're right.
All I'm saying, throughout the financial crisis, and you wrote something on this that I found interesting. But so if I had said, you know, I mean, part of it was to be provocative, was simply to say there are clearly excesses on Wall Street. There are clearly lots and lots of major problems, but there is also something very valuable. And I don't know how you look at history or you know, comparative economics today and not conclude that some form of credit system is a crucial ingredient. It's not sufficient, but it's necessary for poor people to become middle class and for middle class people to improve their quality of life. If you don't have that system, you don't get middle class people.
Well, yes, but I'll say a couple of things. One, even in some semi-realistic socialist economic model I could develop in my head, there'd be a credit system for enterprises and, you know, some kind of social bank or something like that. You look at the cooperatives in Mondragon, they have a some sort of cooperative bank at the center. You need that. You know, some enterprises will be in surplus, some will be in deficit. You need to link those two. And making major purchases for consumers need a credit system. But it's also often a substitute for real resources. Now, I would think for the student debt issue, now we're, you know, approaching $1 trillion or over it, depending upon whose count you believe. And a very important part of that is we've seen enormous cutbacks in state support of public universities. We could have free higher ed in this country for about 1% of GDP. It's not expensive. We wouldn't have all this debt problems. But we don't. It's a social policy not to have that. It's a social policy actually to increase the cost to individuals of going to college. So that is a use of a credit system to patch up something that really needs to be done differently.
I'm speaking with Adam Davidson, who is a columnist for the New York Times Magazine and host of NPR's Planet Money.
One of the kind of big issues that I wanted to talk to you about is, to some degree, I feel sort of silly. Like it's. I think there's a New Yorker cartoon or something, like someone was mean to me on the internet.
Used to be the New Yorker building?
It was. This was the New Yorker office.
So. Yeah. Oh, it was.
But, you know, someone was mean to me on the internet. But what's one thing that's very frustrating is, I mean, we're having a substantive conversation now. There's clearly a lot that we might agree on, a lot we might disagree on. There's nuances. And there's something about, and part of me feels this is just silly. Like, that's what the internet is. That's what happens. But there's something about when you mean something subtle, like the person got this particular detail wrong or the person got that point wrong, you haven't said that. You've said Adam Davidson is wretched. Adam Davidson, you know, and that is, it's frustrating. Like, you can imagine reading that and thinking, wait, no. I'm like, first of all, maybe I made a mistake. I think I should have explained what I meant when I said Wall Street more clearly. I do think that's a mistake. Of course I make mistakes. We all make mistakes. And other times I think, no, I got a pretty solid substantive defense to what you're saying. And let me just, like, so you know, and I've had, since the internet existed, I've had a bit of a, you know, I've been a reporter at places that had internet policy, so I haven't been a commenter in that way. I know my personality. I'm sure that I would have been leaving lots of, like, nasty, you know, I'm a native New Yorker, and I'm certainly capable of saying in private lots of nasty things that are way nastier than anything you've ever written. So I'm not saying this as like some sweetheart outsider who's always kind and generous. But there is, I guess I just wanted to say that. Like, it's just frustrating because it's like, wait, no, I guess what I want to say is I feel like, well, there's actually two different points. Let me just finish the first point. The first point is just, I guess it really is. Why so insulting? Why not? I disagreed with this point. I thought he could have said it this way. Or
Well, I have to say, now that I've met you, I'll never call you wretched again. But that's part of the thing about...
Well, let's see where the conversation goes. You might call me way more wretched.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No, but the part of the thing about...
And I don't mean to, like, really, 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 I want to say, like, I feel like a kindred spirit. I'm not, like, in that sense. I'm not...
Yeah.
I realize I'm kind of putting you on the spot in an uncomfortable way, and I actually feel badly about that. But it's a question I've had, so...
Well, I think, like I said, when one is not sitting in front of someone or has the possibility of doing that, you say things you might not otherwise.
Right.
And the Internet is famous for doing that.
Yeah, yeah.
And the tone of so many comments on the Internet is, much more heat than light. I was, since I wrote that book about Wall Street, I know this stuff really well, and feel very strongly about certain aspects of what Wall Street does. I was just angered to see that these assertions just rolled out without any kind of evidence or self-questioning. But there's also, I'm a little guy. You have the New York Times and NPR is far bigger than any kind of medium I've ever been near. And that's how you get attention, is by shouting. If you're trying to knock down a very large wall, you don't use a pinprick.
Right. So, and by the way, this is something I take very seriously. Like, there are moments where I read your comments or other people's comments, and I have an immediate, like, I feel like I'm the victim here, and this is terrible. And I do say to myself, you know what? I've been given this incredible gift of a mass, not just one, but two massive platforms. That's an incredibly lucky thing. It's something to take very seriously, and part of it means that I need to be very open to criticism. And so I really do actually, and actually my editor at the New York Times Magazine, there's another blogger who's far nastier about me, frankly, and he makes a point of, like, let's...
Oh, really? Who's that?
Eve Smith.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And she wouldn't even, she wrote in a blog post that I sent her an email, and she said, I wouldn't even open his email.
Really?
Oh. Yeah. And
I like Eve Smith a lot, but I certainly opened your email, and I was very impressed that you got in touch with me.
And I do take it, like, I I've been criticized on the right too, I should note. It's not just the left that hates me sometimes, but I actually, even some very invective filled comments, I try and say, all right, did I mess up here? Did I miss something? I take that very seriously. So I think part of getting a job writing a column for the New York Times or hosting a show on NPR is I have to roll with the punches. But I find that interesting, what you said. Like, so if your blog posts or your tweets would not be forwarded as much if you just said, I had a slight nuanceical disagreement.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's and this is part of the problem with the whole medium. My friend Jody Dean wrote this whole book called Blog Theory. It's very from kind of high theory perspective, but
Is it good?
I like it a lot.
Yeah.
One of her points is, unlike conventional written stuff, there's a sense that when you write a blog post, it just goes out there into the ether. And somebody else might link to it. But, it has no life. It doesn't... Gary Steingart does these great little mock blurbs, and he wrote one the other day. So-and-so has written a tweet that is destined to last for hours. And so in that kind of atmosphere, it's just like you just press the send button, It's just like, and all you want to do is be relinked and retweeted and linked to and all that. It does encourage that kind of extraordinary shouting
right.
behavior. But also, I was also, as I opened the piece, my blog post that I wrote that went after your Wall Street column, I started with by mentioning something about, I find NPR very annoying, that it, I think, is extremely conventional, but has a reputation for not being so. It has a reputation for being critical and more intellectual and more liberal, and I think it's, and as I said, I think in some ways its effects are more sinister than those of Fox, because Fox preaches the converted, and a lot of people who listen to NPR would be open to more critical points of view that are simply not presented. And then because NPR says it has a credibility to them that it wouldn't if it were coming from a commercial source. This kind of fed into my longstanding desire to write a polemic about NPR's social effects.
And I was the lucky guy who
got it. And you were the lucky guy. It happened to be something about I knew very well and I was
right.
able to. Because I don't listen to NPR very much. When I was first together with the woman who's now my wife and has been for 10 years, she used to wake up to All Things Considered.
Morning edition,
okay.
Yeah.
But the sound of the voices just drove me crazy. The music drove me crazy. There was a kind of apologetics and complacency and almost a narrow-mindedness in the tone even of the whole thing that made me want to scream, and I made her stop listening to it. I still feel that way about NPR, and I'm sure this is not going to ingratiate me for further invitations back here. But this was, I thought, like the first take of something that was going to express that. I do have that problem with NPR's this NPR sensibility, and you know, it really is essentially corporate funded and represents a kind of, I don't know if I want to use my Marxist jargon, a liberal bourgeoisie that I think a large portion of the listenership would be open to stuff that were more critical of that if it were available, and it's not. And that's one of the things that frustrates me so much. So I thought that this piece that ended up being what looked like to me like apologetics for Wall Street would have that kind of sinister effect of leading a bunch of people who might ask more critical questions or want somebody to ask them on their behalf to say, oh, okay, I guess that's all right.
We're listening to a conversation I had several weeks ago with Adam Davidson, host of NPR's Planet Money and a columnist for New York Times Magazine. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break with the second half of my chat with Adam Davidson. Some of We Are All Bourgeois Now by the British Marxist indie pop band McCarthy. And now back to my conversation with Adam Davidson, host of NPR's Planet Money and a columnist for the New York Times Magazine, recorded at NPR's New York studios a couple of weeks ago. As I said at the top of the show, Davidson invited me in to talk about a rather harsh polemical attack I'd made on him over a column he'd written for the Times Magazine. I'm impressed by his openness to his critics, though we will see what he does with it in the future.
I have a few thoughts in response to that. One thought is that I didn't think it was by any means my best piece, and we actually did have some serious talks about why doesn't this piece feel good to us, like me and my editors? And the conclusion, I don't think it's as bad as you did, and I don't think it's just a horrible apologetics to Wall Street. And my preference both for reading and for writing is, you know, if I can say, is maybe a subtler gloss than your work, although I value, you know, stronger, you know, polemic. You know, I like reading that too. But the main thing that I didn't like about that column is it was too assertive. And I think that I feel most comfortable, and I think the value of my team, Planet Money, and I actually think we're pretty good and you might even like us. And I think one of our strengths, and which I'm very proud of, is not holding ourselves up as expert authorities or as people who figured it out, but holding ourselves up as curious, eager to understand, and people with reporting resources that the average person doesn't have, so that we can actually dig into the things that make us curious. But not, you know, one of my critiques of a lot of business and economics coverage is it's sort of presented as here's some expert in a suit who's talking about things you don't understand, but they know it inside and out. And it took me a long time as a business journalist to realize all those people on TV or on the radio.
How'd you get here?
I mean, actually, the funny thing for me is, you know, I grew up in I don't know if it's as left a world as you can, but it's a pretty left world. I grew up in West Bethel's government-subsidized housing for artists in the Village and, you know, in a world where I didn't know. My dad's dad was a Republican, but we didn't really know him. So I didn't know any Republicans. In my childhood, Ronald Reagan was the most evil human being. And I, as a kid, I just didn't understand how he kept getting elected since absolutely nobody had ever voted for him. And I was never, I mean, it was a world that didn't care about Wall Street or money. And I sort of fell into it like most business journalists that I know, you know, got a job, needed a job, got one at Marketplace, the public radio business show, and eventually thought, oh, okay, this offers some systematic ways of understanding our society. But I've never been someone who's fascinated by stock prices or, you know, it's more as a tool to understand other.
Yeah, I have a love-hate relationship with Wall Street. I have since I was like 14, so.
Did you grow up in the city? Or
no, I grew up in New Jersey, but my uncle who lived with us when I was a kid subscribed to Barron's, and I picked that up and just, this is interesting stuff. But you know, my first job out of college was at a small brokerage firm. It was the only place I could find a job, and it lasted only 6 months before the place went under. But it was one of the early quants, this guy who was had been a physicist at Bell Labs.
That's what Westbeth was before.
Yeah.
It was Westbeth. It was
Bell Labs. And he started early in the days of listed options trading, so he wanted to bring mathematical modeling to options pricing. So it was like Black and Scholes was new and all this stuff, and C-Head. So I was like trying to write computer programs for him.
So this is like 70-ish?
1975. Yeah. And then when the firm went bust, I decided to go to graduate school in English, of all things. And so, but then I never lost that fascination with that world.
Right.
Some years later, I started, like, just thought, oh, I was reading a lot of the business press. I'll start doing this newsletter about economics and finance. And then a few years later, Verso asked me to do a book on Wall Street. And so I spent 6 years reading, you know, everything from Keynes to efficient market theory, doing a lot of interviewing and, you know, traveling around. And that's really when I, you know, sort of finally got the feeling I understood what was going on.
Right. So you, like me, have spent, well, I've spent a lot less time than you. I've spent about 12 years, but we both have spent a lot of time studying extraordinarily rich people, but somehow managed to not get rich ourselves.
Yeah. So, yeah. Actually, the first line of the Wall Street book is it would take years of psychoanalysis to uncover what it is that drew somebody
right
to this field.
There's a couple kind of uber thoughts I have that I think drive my work. And it's sort of all I would write about if my editors would let me, but the readers don't seem to be. Oh, I wanted to respond to one thing you said, which is I think readers are much smarter and more critical than you're giving them credit for. I have not, at least New York Times, NPR, I have not experienced our listeners or readers as people who just take what you say and assume it's true. That is not my experience. My experience is they're extremely critical listeners, that they don't automatically trust you. There is no authority of your status. Maybe that was true in an earlier age, but that certainly hasn't been true for my entire career.
He's just saying in the public opinion business, we can't tell people what to think, but we can tell them what to think about.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair.
Yeah.
And I think NPR is better than most at not just jumping on whatever's the latest hot thing. But yeah, I do agree with that. That can happen. The other point, I just want to quickly say of NPR, I think we are intelligent. I enjoy listening to us, but we're not liberal, and we don't try to be liberal. We're proudly not liberal.
Right.
We're also proudly not conservative. And I know in this day and age that seems like a ridiculous thing to even say. But I honestly and truly feel I am in my heart nonpartisan. And
well, it's perceived by I think a lot of people as liberal, whether that's true or not.
I don't think that's something that we can.
No.
Take responsibility for or that I should that should affect how I do my work.
Right.
Or,
no, know. But I think it's perceived by both people, both liberals and conservatives would perceive, if you ask people to classify it.
Oh, no, certainly. But here's the other area that I wanted to address, which is certainty. I came to economics, or I sort of fell in love with economics originally because I thought it would give me the answers, and I thought it was filled with people who actually truly understood how the economy works and therefore in many ways how politics works, how humanity works. And what's become clearer and clearer to me is economists don't have almost any answers at all. There's almost no consensus on almost anything. And I mean, to get a consensus among economists, you have to ask questions in a very broad way. Like, is trade generally good?
Yeah, I was going to say that's the one that's the closest consensus with the biggest.
That's the
trade.
Biggest one,
yeah,
trade.
Yeah.
But
and, you know, I would kind of go along with that. Yeah. I'm not comfortable with a lot of the protectionism on the left.
Yeah. But you've articulated, you know, so one thing you wrote about me is that, let me just put it this way. Like, isn't it possible that I'm not a tool of the right? I'm not a tool of Wall Street. And I just came to different conclusions than you, or I just haven't come to conclusions that you have.
I wouldn't call you a tool. No. Yeah. You know, one polemicizes for propagandistic purposes.
Yeah.
My late friend Bob Fitch, I just did a memorial for, used to use the term capitalist hyena press now and then. And it's fun to throw things around like that. And, you know, I really don't like a lot of, you know, when you hear these people calling for more civility and discourse, that stuff, I really, I don't know.
I like a tough marketplace of ideas. A boxing match of ideas.
Yes, as Keynes said of Marxism, it's controversializing. I like controversializing. But, you know, as he also said, Keynes was critical, very critical of using statistical techniques in economics, and he said economics requires a lot of introspection and judgments of value. And, you know, that's a lot of what this is all about. I mean, people have different political and aesthetic and social preferences, and they will use what evidence they can marshal to support those. But, you know, a lot of it is a matter of temperament or interest or habit or whatever. And in economics, like the other social sciences, there's really no right or wrong answer. Joan Robinson said that, you know, economics likes to think of itself as the hardest of the social sciences, but next to physics, it's astrology. And, you know, there's something to that.
Yeah. One of the guys on my team, David Kestenbaum, has a PhD in physics from Harvard. And he said, you know, when he started reporting on economics, which he had no background in, he just said, you know, in physics, we address a problem, we struggle with it for a while, and then we resolve it, and then we move on to a new problem. And here we are, you know, the hottest debates going, you know, were the ones that Keynes and Hayek discussed over lunch in, you know, 1935 or whatever.
Yeah.
And we're still trying to figure out, what would Keynes have said? Well, actually, what would Milton Friedman say? You know, sometimes we get all the way to the 1960s. So are you a Marxist?
In some sense, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what that means for practical political action, but it's certainly how I understand capitalism.
Which is to say capitalism is a stage, and that eventually we will...
No, who knows what the future holds. But what I mean is that ultimately it's a system, it's a class-based system in which the rich get rich through the uncompensated labor of the working class. And that a lot of the stuff that finance is about is redistributing that surplus in very strange ways. Also, my understanding of the financial markets is that they are essentially institutions of class power and formation, so that the stock market is a system for organizing ownership of the productive apparatus, and bond markets participate in that when it's the corporate bond market, but you know, they have a good deal of power over governments through the government bond markets. So I think, you know, certainly there's a lot of stuff going on with, you know, flows of funds kinds of analysis, you know, saving and borrowing and, you know, stocks and this and that. But I think that it's also important to look at that political dimension, that the markets are not neutral. They do represent a certain set of people with very definite interests. And so they are class institutions.
Now, my understanding of economic history is that middle classes appear in places with systems that are closer to capitalism. You know, obviously we've never had pure Marxism or pure capitalism anywhere, and to some degree all capitalist systems have profound rent seeking and political intervention that often distorts things for the rich, and I think that's incontrovertible. I mean, I think any University of Chicago economist would agree with that, and I'm assuming you would agree that we have not yet seen anything approaching pure Marxism, whatever that would mean.
No.
Yeah. But my core issue, if I have one, I mean, my core economic question is, why are there so many poor people in the world? And I go to the place that I think this would be something close to a consensus view among economists, although they have huge squabbles over the details, that the answer for Haiti and much of Latin America and much of Sub-Saharan Africa and parts of Asia is more markets, not fewer, and that's sort of what has worked. Now, we can get into huge debates about, you know, how you do it, and obviously when it's been done from the outside, it's pretty much always been a disaster, and so I'm not saying it's, you know, it's sort of my necessary sufficient thing. It's not, you know, I think there's a lot of confidence in the 80s and 90s that we figured this one out, we're going to show up and just show you how to become a prosperous middle, you know, middle class. And we know that's not true. And in fact, we don't know right now, I think, what to say to Haiti or any other very poor country.
Well, Haiti is, who knows even where to start with Haiti.
Yeah. And Haiti, I mean, it's like talking about Greece. It's like such a one-off that it's not clear that it has valuable lessons for anywhere else. But so that, like, to say, am I a capitalist? I mean, I would say that some variation of the Churchill quote, like, it has huge problems. It's hugely problematic. It's prone, like all systems, to political interference and blah, blah, blah. But some version of it is the best thing we've come up with yet to make very, very poor people into middle class people. And so that makes me think that's a pretty good track record in a very sad and horrible world.
Well, you know, it's hard to beat Marx's admiration for the powers of capitalism to create wealth. I mean, if you look at the opening pages of the Communist Manifesto, it's almost a celebration of the powers of capitalists to make people wealthy, but also bridge international boundaries, create a world literature, just spur all kinds of technological innovations. There's a lot of admiration for what capitalism could do, and I think that's one of the things that, off track, but, you know, one of the things that bothers me about a lot of people on the left now, including a lot of people around the Occupy movement, is this unwillingness to admire that portion of capitalism that is bold and creative. And I think part of the problem in the United States now is that it's lost a lot of that. It's become decadent and rotten. And I think a good bit of the reason for that is that our elite has gotten so rich and has had so few challenges to its power. Now, you compare the Gilded Age of the late 19th century, when there were, you know, labor radicals and populists, and there was all kinds of political unrest, and that spurred a good deal of political and technological innovation. And now I think it's just gotten fat and complacent and lazy. But I would also say that, you know, it took a lot of state action to make those markets happen. The infrastructure investment of the 19th century, the canals and railroads, you know, the United States would not be what it is without that kind of investment. New York City would not be what it is without the Erie Canal and all that sort of thing. And then I was talking earlier about all the subsidies to research and development that the federal government has provided over the last decades. So you need, and, you know, China. That is not what we'd call a conventional market economy,
right.
And it's certainly the most successful. But, you know, what Japan did from the 50s through the 70s, what Korea did in subsequent decades, I mean, that was all, as Alice Amston said, they got prices wrong very deliberately. And, you know, to a development economist, it's all about getting prices right, but there are not very many successful examples of that, where there are of the Asian interventionist model. But, you know, in the real world, I would say I don't think we're going to have the workers' paradise any time in the lifetime of, you know, if I have great-grandchildren.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, there's a lot to admire in the Scandinavian social democracies, I think. And they have much, just in percentage terms, much larger middle classes than we do. We have about the most polarized income distribution in the first world and the smallest middle income cohort in the first world. And they have the largest. And you need state, the combination of taxation, but spending is also very, very important. They don't have particularly progressive tax structures, but they do have very progressive spending policies. And it provides people an enormous amount of freedom to live. And the social benefits are provided to people as of right. You know, they don't have to be in families or have to be employed to get them the way they do in Germany, for example. I think there's a lot to admire in that. And they're also the healthiest economies in Europe now. They're not really in crisis. They have very innovative companies, and there are an awful lot of very impressive Scandinavian companies on a world scale. So you can have an innovative economy that coexists with social justice.
How confident are you that your analysis is right?
It depends upon what portion you're talking about. What I just said, I'm very confident that I'm right, that you can have social justice that coexists with innovative economies, and that it requires active state to have even a healthy capitalist economy. And I think we've reached the point in this country where we have none of those things, and it's to both our economic and social detriment.
So, I mean, I think this is where it's sort of, in this new media landscape that we exist in, there's like this weird... It's always existed in some form. It's just, you know, the internet makes it mixes things up a bit, which is I don't think it's appropriate for the New York Times or NPR to have a broad and solid economic philosophy or a economic approach, you know, like a Marxian analysis.
Well, of course
or a,
not. No.
Yeah. Like, I don't think it's my job to have that. I guess, I mean, you could argue that, you know, I, in the broadest, tepidest way possible, I endorse capitalism. I guess I would accept that. But, you know, my argument would be that I'm writing within a system, and that's the system we have, and I don't see it as my role of, in that level of fundamental way, questioning the system we have. And so I just wonder, could I really write things that you would say, yes, that, short of becoming a partisan in this fight?
I don't expect NPR or New York Times to take on that role. I mean, there's certainly political press, you know, there are political media that do those sorts of things, and for broad general interest media, it's just not going to see that kind of advocacy. But there could be more openness to and recognition of the existence of those opinions than there is. There's just not much openness to even reporting the existence of a point of view like mine. And you know, I like to think I know a lot about what I'm talking about. I'm not just like sounding off in a polemical way. I really, you know, try to offer evidence. And that's one of the things that, you know, bothers me about so much of the stuff that I read. Well, you know, this is hegemony for you. This is, you know, the dominant social power can say things without having to feel like it needs a footnote to justify the claim. And everything I say is going to be challenged and I have to back it up. But, you know, then also, as I was saying earlier, a lot of it's just judgments of value. You know, we just have different worldviews and that there's no way to make those compatible, and you're not likely to convert somebody just on the basis of rational argument. But there does need to be more openness. You know, when I was in college, I was on the far right. I was a member of the Party of the Right at Yale, and I was a libertarian in those days. It lasted me about a year and a half, 2 years. But we felt very excluded then. It's been a very strange experience to watch what used to be extremely marginal views become very respectable. The kinds of things you hear Republican leaders say now is the stuff that a dozen weirdos in the Party of the Right were saying in 1971, and now it's on, you know, it's a good bit of the U.S. Congress holds these.
And
parties.
If anything, the left has diminished over that same
period. Oh, completely, yeah. Diminished completely.
And positions that were seen as influential and respectable on the left are now seen as radical.
Yeah, we just don't exist.
Yeah. So it's, to bring it back to me, the most important issue. So you're mad at me because I'm part of a system that you're mad at. And I can tell right now I don't get the sense you're mad at me. But in general, you're mad at...
When you express
anger at me, you're expressing anger at a whole system.
Well, yeah, but then the Wall Street piece that really set me off, though, I thought that asserted a whole lot of things that were misleading. Because the stuff like credit being somehow a substitute for income was really...
Well, I didn't say that. So I've established, like, I wish I had said financial system overall and been more precise in my definitions, that I wasn't talking about equities. But I think I'm just going to have to strongly disagree with you that credit on balance hurts poor people or hurts middle class people. I think on balance, I'm talking over the march of history, looking at countries that have credit systems, looking at countries that don't. It's miraculous. It's a wonderful system. It allows people to time travel. It allows them to spend future earnings today, which allows them to acquire the material and skill that allows them to get those future earnings.
I would say it's true of middle-income people who use it carefully. But for poor people, well, many can't get credit at all. But if those who do, they get it in horrendous terms. So they're you know, paying through the nose for like payday loans and things like that.
There's terrible examples of credit. There's no question. But I would say on balance.
Yeah, I don't think that credit is very good for poverty reduction. I don't think there's very many examples of that. I think it's okay for middle class people who want to buy a car or buy a house and they use it carefully and don't get it over their heads. And it does all those things you say. But I don't think that applies to the poor.
I hate to say we'll have to agree to disagree. I mean, here's my conclusion. Like, my conclusion is I just have to shut up and take it. Like what I said. I mean, my conclusion is I can reach out to you when I can. I think now we have a dialogue, and I hope that if you read something you can't stand, that feel free to write whatever you want, but maybe you'd email me or say, like, did you get, you know, I think you missed this or you missed that, or and maybe I'd be able to say.
Well, now that I met you, I know there will be no more epithets unless you say something nasty about me.
Okay, right. And Doug Headwood is a bastard. but, and that's, I much prefer that. I mean, Dean Baker once wrote a pretty mean post about me, and he and now I talk to him almost every week. We're we're buddies, and I find him enormously helpful. And he said he's going to try not to write as many blog posts at 5 a.m. when he's kind of groggy and in a bad mood. So I'm trying to come to some grand conclusion, I guess. But I think in sort of a meta way, you and I, like, we might not agree on lots of specific economic issues or even any economic issues maybe, but I think a vibrant debate is good, and I have a big platform, so I have to be a little more polite, and you don't, so you get to have a little more fun sometimes, and that's okay. Is that fair?
Yeah, but I would say, you know, I guess in conclusion, that you wouldn't have this job if you were thought like me. You wouldn't be here. You wouldn't have the Times column if you thought like me. But I do wish it were possible for entities like NPR and the Times to listen a little more or give a little more coverage to people like me, because we have something to say, and we get virtually no outlet to say it other than just to ourselves, to our small little echo chamber. And I think, you know, there are enough people out there who might be interested in hearing something like this.
And I'm assuming that, in your view, that's not an accident. That's not, and it's also not just we don't like you or your, it's a political system. It's a economic structure.
Yeah, well, that's how ideology works. You know, Alexander Coburn wrote years ago that the mission of the bourgeois press is to fire dense volleys of cliché into the prejudices of its readers. I think it's true a lot of the left press. Any kind of press does that. But I think there is an impulse to stay with something that's safe and not at all disruptive.
All right, Doug, thank you so much. I'm really glad we had this conversation.
That was a conversation with Adam Davidson, host of NPR's Planet Money and a columnist for the New York Times Magazine, recorded at NPR's New York studios a couple of weeks ago. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this. Some more from McCarthy, this The Well of Loneliness. No relation to the famous lesbian novel, I'm sorry to say. The band's comment on this song is that it's a voice of a professional defeatist, which I swear I'm not. For those of you listening on KPFA, remember, I'll be back not next Saturday, but Thursday at noon. Till then, bye. You sit still.